Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Veteran sports journalist Phil Pepe wants you to know his newest book is not a memoir. His philosophy is that most people don't care about the writer, how he got his job, the day-to-day doings. I disagree, but that's just me. Pepe, who recently turned 80, has been covering baseball since the late 1950s and has witnessed some amazing events over his long career. While he's written dozens of his own books, he's also served as co-author with such personalities as Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Gary Carter, Bob Gibson, Buddy Harrelson, Ken Griffey Sr., and Howie Rose, just to name a few. He humbly maintains that readers are more interested in meeting the players at author events than the craftsmen and women who actually wrote the stories. We spoke recently about his latest publication, Yankee Doodles, and the sweet memories writing it brought up for him.
Phil Pepe, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, early on in your new book, Yankee Doodles, you write about a time when writers traveled with the team. And that reminded me of a scene from Eight Men Out, when the reporters gather around a fantastic spread put out by team owner Charles Comiskey. So my question is, when you were starting out, what was the relationship between writers and the teams they covered?
Well, the very first trip I ever made, I made on a sleeper, and I had never been on a sleeper before.
Well, which is a train for those of us who are too young to know what that is.
Yeah, we were going to Cleveland, and I was like filling in for the veteran, the guy who had normally covered the Yankees, because he was going to do some football instead. It was late in the season, and so I go to Grand Central Station and. They show me where to go, and I get in. They give me a compartment, and the thing that's vivid in my mind is that when I went to go to sleep that night, there was a little compartment that said shoes. So you put your shoes in there. When I wake up the next morning, my shoes were shining, and I couldn't figure out how they got a little man to get into that compartment to shine my shoes. So, but that was a lifestyle that I really knew very little about, read about it. And it lingered a little longer with the Yankees because the traveling secretary at the time was a man by the name of Bill McCrory. He was an old spitball pitcher, and he was a dinosaur back then and hated to fly. And any time he could – I found out this out later – any time he could substitute a train for a plane, he took advantage of that, and that's how I got on that. And it gave me a sense of what it must have been like in the old – days, the Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig days, where writers and players were thrown together, and very often they formed strong relationships. They played cards together. They ate dinner together because they were captive. They couldn't go anywhere, you know. So most of the, I'm not sure whether there are other people on the train. There probably were, but the team probably had a group of cars. Set aside for their exclusive use, and so these people were thrown together for the length of time it took to go from one city to the next.
Do you recall how long that took? What was the commute for? How many hours did that take?
Well, all I knew was that I fell asleep and woke up the next morning in Cleveland, and I don't know whether the train had to wait until it was a respectable time. It probably, I mean, it was an overnight trip. What's the distance between New York and Cleveland?
Yeah.
250, 300 miles? I have no idea.
Uh-huh. So when you're covering a team in that proximity, is there a sense of – well, and the team paid for the writers to travel, correct?
That's
or to the
correct.
Newspapers. Mm-hmm. So if the team pays for it, is there some sort of sense of, well, gee, you know, I got to do a nice job for the team rather than for whatever newspaper you're writing for?
Well, unfortunately or fortunately, I was not a regular, so I really didn't understand all of that. I wasn't affected by any of that. I imagine there were people who were. There's a famous story about how Ralph Houck got into a fight on the train with one of the writers and wound up punching the writer. I forget who the writer was, but there was some kind of an incident. Those things happen. So apparently, you know, I guess it was just an individual thing. If you were a houseman, quote unquote, then you were sympathetic to the team you were traveling with. I imagine that relationships were formed where a writer would be reluctant to write negatively about a player he befriended or who befriended him. I imagine those things happened, but I really was removed from that because I wasn't around enough to have experienced that.
So when did that start to change? When did it stop becoming a situation where the writers travel with the team and on the team's dime?
Well, I think it stopped fairly early in my career. I mean, by the time I was a regular beat writer, the newspapers were no longer accepting free travel or free hotel rooms. However, the other teams in New York, like the Knicks and the Rangers, were still doing that, and they did it because they wanted the coverage. The papers were not going to cover the Knicks on the road or the Rangers on the road because they couldn't afford to send the people there. Yeah. Baseball was going to be covered regardless, and I imagine football, even since it was only a once-a-week deal, they were going to get their coverage. But the Rangers and the Knicks, for example, were not going to get that coverage. And then when the Jets came into being, when they were the Titans, they spent the money to get the writers to go on trips with them. The Giants were already entrenched, so they didn't need to do that, but the Jets needed that, or the Titans needed that publicity. So in my career, it was never a situation in baseball where the teams were paying for the writers to travel. There were occasional examples where when you were on the road trip, they might take all the writers out for a dinner. But other than that, there was nothing free. You know, we weren't getting handouts in any way.
When did you start? I mean, I should have asked that at the beginning.
Well, the first trip I ever made was in 1959. But I didn't I started covering the team regularly. I was assigned to be the beat writer in the middle of the 1961 season, you know, right in the heart of that M&M battle for the home run championship. And that's when I picked up the team and then resumed covering the Yankees for the old World Telegram and Sun for several years.
Now, we've heard a lot about the relationship between Roger Maris and the writers in 1961 when he was trying to break Ruth's record. But as someone who was there, what do you think about the depiction of that relationship? Do you think it's accurate? Do you think it's fair?
Well, I don't know whose depiction you're talking about because there have been several. And I can tell you what I experienced. Roger Maris was a very nice man. He was cordial and agreeable and cooperative to a point, but he also was a private individual, and he didn't want to be bothered with talking about his personal life. And it got to the point where the home run record became a drag for him. You know, the questions just got to be intolerable because they were constant. He also was not a very verbal individual. He wasn't well educated, and he was not a very good interviewer. And he would sit and answer questions, but you came away hoping that he would have been able to contribute more. He was never nasty. He never refused to talk. Well, there was one time he did refuse, but generally he was there to answer the questions. It's just that what he offered, kind of like Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter answers questions and says nothing.
One of the chapters in Yankee Doodles recalls a situation where Fritz Peterson and Mike Kekich, two pitchers in the 70s, traded families. They traded wives, children, houses, pets. Was there any editorial consideration, not only from the paper that you wrote for, but of New York press in general, about not running a story like this? Or was it just so bizarre that they couldn't not run it?
No, yeah. No, what you just said is true. Yeah, you had to write about it. I mean, you knew I imagine if all the writers had gotten together and said, no, we're not going to write about this, then maybe it might not have come to light. But that was not going to happen because it actually broke We were in Fort Lauderdale when it happened, but it broke on the other coast because I think Milt Richmond found out about it, and he made some mention of it, and that's the reason the Yankees felt they had to make an announcement, because it was already out in the open, and it was going to hit big. I mean, you can't imagine what it would be like today with all the social media.
Right.
I mean, all the... It was relatively downplayed back then, if you can imagine that. It shouldn't have been, but it was, because that was the nature of the times. If it happened today, it would have been monstrous. I mean, people would be coming down to spring training from every agency, every newspaper, radio, television agency. It'd be inundated with the media. But that wasn't exactly the case. In fact, there was that one story where they didn't invite the reporter for the New York Post to the meeting when they made the announcement, because it was a woman who was – the Post had sent down a woman to cover spring training as a gimmick. You know, she was really not a baseball writer. She was a reporter for the paper, and she was a good writer, and she was a nice person. And they sent her to cover spring training to get, like, kind of a woman's point of view. This was in the days before women were covering baseball or covering sports. So they chose not to invite her to the little meeting in which they made the announcement. I mean, that's unthinkable. How do you exclude the New York Post or any New York paper from a story of that magnitude?
Sure. Now, this is a relatively short book, and you cover just a handful of personalities on the team. How did you decide who to include?
Based on the stories that I've been telling people for years and seem to be garner some interest, I didn't want to sit down and write 3,000 words or 300-400 pages. There are certain things I wanted to put in writing that I hadn't written about before. Most of them I told people verbally, and I just selected the things that I found amusing and interesting, and I thought that the people that I had told those stories to found them amusing. I didn't want it to be – first of all, I didn't want it to be a memoir, so to speak. I mean, I don't believe that sports writers are important enough to have their own memoirs of how I got my job and how I did this and how I did that. But I think fans are interested in what the relationship was. I was in a situation, not only me, but people who were doing the job I did were in a situation where any fan would have loved to have been there with us. But we had the opportunity to have contact with the so-called heroes, and I just thought it was something that might be interesting. And frankly, I had a tough time even selling this book. There wasn't enough interest in it, but this one publisher decided that it would make a nice, readable, small book, and they were kind enough to allow me to do it. And I just wanted to get some things off my chest.
Hmm. After reading your chapter on Reggie Jackson, I was reminded, and I wish I knew who said it, that history is reported by witnesses and participants. Jackson and Billy Martin each had a version of what happened on that day in Boston when Martin pulled Jackson out in the middle of an inning for what he perceived as loafing after a fly ball and showing up the team. And I was wondering, you know, he has his version, Jackson had his version, which changes over time. How do you craft your version of what happened?
Well, I think it was there was bad blood between them. I think Billy, that's been documented. Billy didn't want Reggie on his team. He would have preferred to have had Joe Rudy, and this is opening a can of worms. I often thought that Billy Martin made one big mistake. I thought that once the Yankees decided to sign him, and it was a great signing at the time, it was the best free agent signing in baseball history. I mean, nobody else had signed a player of that stature for the amount of money that he got, but it was a tremendous thing, and that was George Steinbrenner's brilliance as an owner and as a showman and whatever else, you know, putting people in the seats. Anyway, so he brings Reggie Jackson in, and Billy is opposed to it. He doesn't like the idea. He wasn't invited to the the meeting between Steinbrenner and Reggie, and so he resented Reggie on his team. And I often thought that all Billy had to do is the day that Reggie Jackson showed up in his clubhouse, that he had come out of his office, run over to him, put his arms around him, gave him a big hello, shook his hand, said, "Hey, big guy, great to have you." He would have won Reggie over, and there never would have been a problem. Mm-hmm. But that was not Billy's nature, and because of his dislike for Reggie and his disapproval of him being a Yankee, that created all the bad blood, and everything happened after that. When they had the talk after Reggie hit the three home runs, I mean, their relationship was interesting. They liked one another in a certain strange kind of a way. They respected one another. They just couldn't get along. They just couldn't get along because they both wanted to be the guy. They both wanted to be number one of the Yankees, and there could only be one number one. Actually, the only number one was George Steinbrenner.
Of all the people you've covered on the Yankees, is there someone who just didn't make the cut for this book?
No, nothing. It had nothing to do with that. I mean, I didn't go by who I liked, who I didn't like. Didn't make the cut. No, I just they didn't make. If they didn't make the cut, is because I couldn't. Well, Chris Chambliss is one of the nicest people I've ever known, but he was too nice. There was no story about Chris Chambliss. Willie Randolph is another one. There was no story about him that was humorous or unusual enough for me to include. So I didn't base it on my likes or dislikes, but whatever I found was humorous or interesting to me is what I tried to include. I mean, the idea of Reggie Jackson giving me his pants, I thought was just an interesting thing. How many people can say that?
I mean, you hear people giving you the shirt off their back, but not the pants off their legs.
Yeah.
The person that comes to mind immediately, just thinking of the personality he's had, was Joe Pepitone. That's the only one that I could come up with that I thought might have made for some interesting stories.
I wish you and I had talked before I did the book. You're
time.
Right. I mean, absolutely. He was a character, and I knew. I'm sorry you told me that because you're making me feel guilty. You know, I covered Joe Pepitone when he was in high school. And I was working for the World Telegram covering high school sports, and I was in my office one afternoon when one of the city side reporters comes over to me and says, "Hey, you know a kid by the name of Joe Pepitone from Manual Training High?" I said, "Yeah, he's a big-time player. He's going to get a big bonus from the Yankees." He says, "I doubt it." I said, "Why?" He said, "He just got shot." You know the story about him getting shot.
Yeah, from his memoir.
And so I had to write the story about it, and it cost him a lot of money. I think he was – I can't remember the figures, but we're talking about the early 1960s. I think he signed for $35,000 when originally they were talking about him getting a bonus of $60,000. And that was a big difference in those days. And, yeah, I knew Joe, and Joe was a Brooklyn guy. I'm a Brooklyn guy. We became pretty good friends, and we didn't hang out together, but we had a good relationship, and he was a terrific player. And it's a story I should have included, and if I do a sequel, I will include it and give you credit.
when a veteran writer such as yourself decides to publish a book like this, and you say these are stories that you've told many times over the years, do you have to go back and do any actual research, or is this just all off the cuff?
Well, some of it is off the cuff, but the research is really based on not the story itself, because I'm never going to forget those stories, but just to fill it out and to set the stage. Yes, I have to do some research, and thank heavens for the internet, you know, and baseballreference.com, all of those things. You need to get the facts, but the stories were there, and I mean they were always going to be there, and I have grown kids, the children who are interested in sports, and I've told them these stories, and I've had I've told these stories to so many people, and they all seem so amused by them. I just had to continue I had to keep them alive somehow. When I'm gone, those stories shouldn't go with me, and I just think that people are going to be amused by them. Sparky Lyle stories, which, you know, just so many things. And also some personal things that not many people know about. Me telling us the anecdote, nobody cares, but I care about how when I was traveling on the road, and Elston Howard, who is a wonderful, lovely man, who I miss to this day, very, very a great human being, and this story depicts that. He and Yogi Berra were very close. They were both coaches on the Billy Martin, and they traveled together. I mean, they hung out together. So they were both from St. Louis. They both lived in New Jersey. They were about the same age, and they both were early risers. And they would always and they weren't roommates, but they would meet every morning for breakfast in the hotel coffee shop wherever we were, Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, so on, and. Occasionally, I would get up maybe an hour later, and they would really be there, and I'd go to the desk and I'd see if I had any messages, and there was a copy of the Daily News in my box, and it was Elston Howard who would buy the paper whenever he could out of New York, whenever he could find one. He'd read it over breakfast, and then instead of tossing it away, he'd leave it for me. And I just thought that was a simple little pleasant gesture, so considerate. That I just thought I would mention that. Nobody would have known about that if I didn't get the opportunity to say that. But I think it tells people what kind of a person Elston Howard was, and I feel it's very important that people should have known that.
We've been talking with Phil Pepe, author of the new book, Yankee Doodles, Inside the Locker Room with Mickey, Yogi, Reggie, and Derek, published by Sports Publishing. Phil, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, I always enjoy doing that, and you've been very kind to me. I appreciate that, Ron.
And that wraps up another baseball conversation. Come back again next time when we'll have another fascinating guest from the world of baseball literature and adjacent items. And don't forget to visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf for the latest news on baseball books with previews, reviews, and interviews. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
But the extras don't carry his name. If old man Columbus had sat in the stands, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."